Hello and welcome to the Plant Paradigm Podcast, where we have inspiring conversations with amazing individuals from all around the world and look for ways to create a clean, green, and sustainable future for us, the planet, and all beings. I'm your host, Tom Simak, a fellow plant eater who strives to optimize every living ecosystem. Passionate about looking after this beautiful floating rock we call home and all the lovely creatures that dwell among it. Thank you so much to everyone who joins us on this journey. And if you're new here, welcome yet again. We talk about all things health, nutrition, mental health, mindset, climate change, mitigation, and how we can be the best version of ourselves and at the same time look after everything and everyone else. If you haven't already, join the conversation on Instagram. That's where we're most active, at plant.paradigm, where I post tips, tricks, and usually those carousel swipe Instagram things on what is actually going on this planet, what is a water shortage, what is climate change, and looking at the data and bringing you the most digestible form of what I've found and from the research that I've done alongside with the guests that we have on this podcast. On that note, I appreciate every single one of you. And of course, those who leave a kind review. We're up to, well, at the moment, we're on a streak of all 5 stars. So if you could continue doing that and leaving us a 5-star review, that would be absolutely amazing. And it means so much. But let's get into today's conversation. It is with the amazing Nick Butter. I was super stoked to have a chat with this guy. And for those of you who haven't heard his incredible stories, you're in for a real treat, especially those who are into fitness or travel. Nick is the first and only person to ever run a marathon in every single country in the world. That took 23 months of running 2 to 3 marathons in 2 to 3 countries every week. His insane story saw him dodging bullets in Guinea-Bissau, crossing battlefields in Syria, feeding off wild dogs in Tanzania, and running along an erupting volcano in Guatemala. All of this saw him set 4 world records and 1 world first, which helped raise £200,000 for Prostate Cancer UK. His story has been featured on CNN, BBC, and The Times. And to top all that, his whole journey was carbon offset. In our conversation, we'll be talking about his travels and lessons along the way, fitness tips, life lessons, veganism, and being environmentally friendly. I think this episode is a real treat and is definitely one of my favorite chats. For those on YouTube, Nick was unfortunately in a situation where the service wasn't great, and so we couldn't establish a video conversation. So unfortunately, this is audio, although I have put it up on YouTube if you do want to look at my pretty face talking to him. But unfortunately, Nick wasn't in a situation in which we could do that. But other than that, I hope you enjoy. Thank you so much for lending me your ears, and I will see you guys on the other side. Mr. Nick Butter, welcome to the Plant Paradigm Podcast. How are you going?
Amazing, mate. Thank you so much, Tom, for having me on.
So, look, firstly, congratulations on the new book. Obviously, it was released a little bit ago now. How are you going with it?
Amazing. Yeah, I'm really pleased. It kind of swiftly climbed up the charts of the bestseller on Amazon, which I was super pleased with. And now it's kind of slowly being released over the rest of the world. So, it was an effort to get everything on paper and relatively concise, and then have to strip so many bits out because there's just so many stories to tell. But yeah, no, I'm really pleased, and people seem to be enjoying it.
Yeah, like obviously I was going to think, like, surely, like, after 196 countries, you'd have to strip just an insane amount. And I was going to ask, like, obviously I want to get the whole cacophony of your story condensed into one episode, which is a little bit of a challenge, as I'm sure you can imagine with, like, the book was. But I want to quickly give a run through of why you turned your head and your heart onto this journey in 2018.
Yeah, so I guess it was a combination of my entire life up to that point. And I think that's what I've come to understand, is that you kind of make decisions based on either conversations or certain bits and pieces, whether it's to buy a car or to go somewhere or to do something or to change a career or whatever it may be. And it's, I think it's actually a combination of lots of bits and pieces. And often the trigger point is just the tipping point of all of those as a combination. And so I'd been running for quite a while. I was running out in the famous race, Marathon des Sables, in the Sahara Desert in Morocco. And there's about 1,000 people that take part in that race. It's over a week in the desert. And I was in a tent with 7 other people. And one of those people was a guy called Kevin. Now, Kevin was 49 at the time and never met him before, but got chatting because, you know, you kind of get friendly when you're in a tent in the desert with each other for a week and you're all running nutters anyway. So you start to get on with each other. And then he dropped this bombshell on me that he had terminal prostate cancer and he was given as little as 2 years to live. And that kind of triggered this little snowball effect of everything that then happened. And I started to understand kind of his perspective on life. He was incredibly happy, and yet he was dying. And there was that disconnect, which I had to get my head around. And I did. And I realized that it was just that he completely valued life and he was going after everything he'd ever dreamed of. And because he had basically an expiry date, he was now able to prioritize everything that he wanted to do, knowing when the end was, basically. And he said to me, don't wait for a diagnosis. He said to me, don't wait for something to happen in your life to give you a kick up the backside, make the change now. And I think that was I was already running all over the place. I was already having an amazing time, but I could have done more. And that was the message that he gave me. And then a few weeks later, the trip was born. I wanted to do something to raise money for the charity. And then we decided we were going to run a marathon in every country in the world.
That's just insane. And for those who have just heard run a marathon in every single country in the world, you're not saying this metaphorically. This is something you literally did. Look, you did everything pretty much solo. It took you 20 months and you ran, from what I remember, 211 marathons. And you know, surely at some stages throughout this journey, like we can assume traveling to every country, period, is just insanely difficult. Now, running a marathon, everyone, it's like adding blocks and barricades in front of you. At some stages where you're just thinking, like, surely this isn't possible.
I went into it very naively because I think if I went into it with my eyes open, I honestly don't know if I would have tried it, because there were so many things that could go wrong. You know, whether it's visas, whether it's the political volatility, whether it's war zones, whether it's climate, whether it's airlines going bust, whether it's all that sort of stuff. And literally everything happened. You know, we had the original plan was to do 220 flights to get me to all of the countries in the world. And that in itself took a good 9 months to actually organize the route that was going to be relatively sensible and wasn't going to be taking me via so many different countries. And everybody would assume that you go by maybe one or two flights to get to each place. But then it turns out that it's sometimes 4 or 5 flights to get to each place. And you know, and that's not cheap either. And so then it starts to snowball. Then you need different passports. Then you need different stamps. And so we went from 220 flights with, we thought, about 3 passports, to 455 flights to 9 passports that we filled up over 23 months. And like you say, the combining the marathon running with the trip, then that was the next huge barrier that we had to overcome. Because once you get into a country, if it's the likes of Yemen or Libya or Iran or Syria, if you actually get in, that's a big tick in the box because that's difficult. But if you get in, then you've got to run, and you've got to run safely, and then you've got to get out quick enough to get to the next place on time before. If you add one day to every country in the world, just one extra day, just one 24-hour period, it will take you another 6 months of your life to finish the trip. And insane. So that's the scale that you just can't keep. You can't just keep going, oh, I'll have another day here. So we planned everything out and basically it went all wrong and we eventually got to the end. That was the story.
That's the brief sum up. Look, a lot of the time, I'm halfway through the book at this stage and I'm thinking, like, my God, like, I've already kind of blurred your experiences together with different cities. Like, where did he get, like, robbed at knife point again? Like, where was it that he saw this? Like, How did you keep track of what you were doing and where you were? And I mean, even putting this book together, like how do you think, oh no, this was in Yemen, this wasn't in like Syria. Like how do you know?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And actually during the edit, my parents and my friends and my family and a few people that I met along the way, plus the publishers, they all had their go at making sure what I was writing was the real events. Because even if even if you write down in your diary, like this happened, you still don't really remember it correctly because you're writing it in a different state of mind. You know, I'm reading my notes in a hydrated, awake state, but I'm writing my notes, you know, a year or 2 years ago. And I'm writing about something that, you know, it's just like making notes on a little pad and you think, all right, well, what does that mean? But fortunately, because we were filming for the documentary, which is coming out on Netflix soon, I had lots of film. And so I used a combination between my diary, my videos that I made, my Instagram post that I wrote, and a very good friend of mine, Mark Beaumont, who has the world record for cycling around the world, is kind of a mentor of mine, really, really lovely guy. He gave me some great advice before he went. He said, whatever you do, just take a dictaphone and record anything that you can think of at the time. And I'm like, don't bother like doing anything else other than just recording the time and the date and the country that you're in, and then talk about what you want to talk about. And that was really, really helpful. But then you add all of that up and then you have a lot of footage and a lot of voice notes and a lot of diary to read through to write the book. So to be honest, I'm as proud of getting the book done and relatively in one piece than I am of actually doing it, because that was a whole other mammoth marathon mission afterwards.
How did you even travel around with Pat? Like I'm thinking all these video footage. I'm a videographer. I know that takes insane amount of data. Like, well, surely half your backpack was just hard drives. How did that work?
Yeah. So I went with, you could tell me if this was just madness or not, but I decided that I traveled with about 90, 128 gig SD cards. So like a big haul of SD cards. And my plan was to not ever write over those cards. And so it wouldn't just like back them up and then write them off and to start again. I would keep them as backups. And so it was like card one, card two, card three. So I had those, but the hard drives, they were actually being sent off. I was uploading all that sort of stuff and they were being sent back home periodically about every 3 months or so. And so I travel with a couple of like 10 terabytes or maybe a couple of 8 terabytes, and then I'd fill it all up and then send it off. But you're absolutely right, that was another mission, because when you're tired and you're sitting in an airport without any electricity, you're frantically trying to back up and you're watching the little progress bar of your files going, please don't die, please don't die. And then eventually you get there and you go, okay, we've got it. And I'm very, very proud to say that I actually didn't lose any footage.
Wow.
I can't believe it. And I didn't even miss a single flight either. And we had lots cancelled, but I didn't miss any. So there was a lot of stuff I look back and go, I don't know how I did that. But yeah, we've got all of the hard drives. I'm actually sitting right next to, I've got a huge safe full of my hard drives because they're like gold dust to me, because they are my memories, which I can't remember everything. So that's where everything is stored.
Mate, Nick, I think you need something called the cloud, and you just need it there forever.
Well, tell you what, you joke, but our plan originally was, because I had a really great friend of mine called Dawn who was uploading my blog post as I went, and we're doing a blog post every week. I would write it on the move, and then she would upload the photos with the words, because I had so little connectivity. But then we got into the point of, during Africa especially, everything just went to pot because there was no Wi-Fi. Like, I couldn't upload anything to the cloud. I could very rarely upload my watch. So I went for about, at one point, I think it was about 15 countries, maybe 10 countries actually, where I hadn't backed up my watch data. And obviously that's what Guinness World Records used to verify my runs. And so if that went, and I needed the internet. So the combination of data, Wi-Fi, and worrying about all of that sort of stuff, that was another kind of level of I've not talked about that on many interviews actually, but that was something that constantly stressed me out.
I'm looking at that now, and we see your accomplishment, and then now we're hearing how difficult it was. Have people come close to doing this, or do you think now that people hear your stories and how insanely difficult everything was, do you think anyone's going to be crazy enough to attempt it?
That's a good point. I honestly don't know, especially now in this world with COVID, because in the Western world, let's say we sort COVID out, and I mean, you guys are a little bit further ahead than the rest of the world, but the rest of the world being the Western developed world, and then you've got the undeveloped or the developing world, and I don't know when that's going to come out of it. So I honestly don't know when it's going to be safe to even travel. I'm going to say like 5 years time, we're still going to have COVID cases in some countries, if not forever. And I don't know what that means for traveling in a relatively quick space of time. You know, I've literally just come back from France in the Alps, and I'm now quarantining for 10 days. And so nobody can do what I did now. But there are a few people that have done. So there's a few people that have run marathon in every European country. So that's 44, which isn't bad, because that's, I mean, it's not the most difficult to get into. But again, there's still some logistical challenges. But I hope the next person that does it, I really would love Dean Karnazes to be that guy, because he's a really lovely bloke, obviously a brilliant ultra runner, literally the ultra marathon man. And he actually had it on his to-do list, his bucket list, and has had it on his website for ages. And I reached out to him afterwards and got the full story about how it's not happened yet. And it's just because it's so difficult. And just being born in Britain makes it much easier. And with him, Dean, being born in the US, makes it a lot more challenging, because the US government was saying to him that actually you can't go to some of these places like North Korea or Yemen or Syria, because it's just, you know, that's just not allowed. And that kind of makes sense. And so there's a whole connection of reasons why I think it's going to be very difficult for somebody to do it again. You know, even if I tried to do it again now, having already done it, I don't think we would be able to because of COVID and Brexit.
Well, that's such, like, surely it gives you some sort of confidence. Like, people, I mean, I haven't met anyone else who's really, like, broken a Guinness World Record, but you think, like, surely a little bit of their mind is always like, oh, who's going to get it next? And especially in the fitness world, things change. Records are broken, you know, all the time, and you've kind of chosen one stupid and big enough to sit there for a very long time. So you've done it at, like, the most perfect time as well.
Yeah, it's nice. I honestly, anybody that would want to do it, I would genuinely give every bit of my time to help them do it, because it's, if I could have everybody in the world do what I've just done, I would love it, because there's so much to gain from it. But the other great thing is that what nobody can ever take away from it is that I did it first, and I feel like I'm proud of that, because you know, you can't do it first again. And so it feels like I ticked a big box, and I just couldn't believe as I stumbled across, nobody'd ever done it before. I just couldn't believe it. I thought, no, somebody must have done it. And then I did it and I realized why. And so I guess that kind of sums it up really.
I love it. And look, a big enjoyable part of your runs and your travel was actually meeting new people, bonding, sharing that excitability and values, but also knowing that you might not ever see these amazing souls again. I'm wondering if you saw this as a lesson in being present with others and how you brought those lessons into your life now.
Yeah, that's really, yeah, really well put. And that was exactly the case. If I could sum up my enjoyment of the whole mission, the one word I would use is people. And I guess I was always the kind of guy that would chat to a random stranger on a plane or on the train or in the London tube. And most people don't. And I think that's quite sad. And it's when I speak in schools or in businesses, I do encourage just active conversation, because if you think about the animal kingdom, and we are animals, we are the most comprehensive and advanced species because we have communication. And so it's such a shame when people don't make that effort to say hello, even if it's just a hello to a random person or hold the door open and just help somebody out, because we are all in this planet together. And that, it brought it to my forefront of my mind so much on running the world, because everybody I met, all walks of life, different races, religions, just so diverse. And the core thing that was the same in everybody was that everybody was understanding that life is there. And when they heard about my story, they were like, yeah, no, this is, this is really worth supporting because it's really cool. And I think there wasn't any walk of life that I came across and they're like, oh, well, that's stupid. You know, there's plenty of countries I went to when they, you know, they didn't run. Like, you know, in Nicaragua, I discovered that lots of people run, but nobody like runs a marathon. Like it's unheard of. People do, but there's like a handful of people. And you think that's just crazy. Like in our society, like you've got people queuing up for years to do certain races. And then in a different part of the world, it's just the opposite. So it just teaches you so much. And so to answer your question, being present with people that we are now, little things like, you know, turning your phone off at meal times and trying to, when you meet new people, like remember their name and look them in the eye more and just be connected, I guess, because in the world of social media it's very easy just to stay connected but from an arm's length, if that makes sense. You know, we're chatting now, which is the most we can do because we're on opposite ends of the planet, but there's lots of people that don't have those conversations even if they're down the road. So yeah, just more conversations, I think, is the one message I want to give to the world of in terms of, you know, travel and what it teaches you.
I love that. Look, throughout your journey, you had so many horrifically scary moments, and a lot of them, I would personally be sitting there kind of accepting death. And you had numerous occasions where you were in some pretty ungodly situations. Did you like go into this knowing that you could potentially be like seriously harmed?
That's a good question again. I suppose I knew that there was dangers, absolutely. What I was most scared of actually wasn't death. It was being locked up in somewhere like Syria and just never being released again. Because I think that is far more likely to happen than to be killed, because we were sensible with our safety. You know, when I was speaking with the safety experts that we hired to work out what I needed to be doing, and we ragged every country on a traffic light system. So the green countries were safe, the amber countries were kind of in the middle, and the red countries are tough. And we went through them and we realized that traffic, like cars, were the significant threat to life, because I was running on the roads all the time and lots of countries don't have any traffic rules really. And so that was a big one. And obviously I did get hit by a car, but I was okay. And then you have things like kidnapping. And so we had to have special kidnap and ransom insurance and making sure that that if I was kidnapped, then the ransom is available and all that sort of stuff. And understanding like that most kidnappings go wrong because they don't have an open line of communication with the kidnapper's family or friends. And so it was very important to go, right, well, if I'm kidnapped, this is the number of the person you need to speak to get the ransom from. And it seems completely backwards because you're like, hang on a minute, you're just gifting them. But yeah, that's the most important thing at that point. You don't want to threaten your life by going, no, you can't speak to anybody and just keeping me forever. You want to pay whatever it is and get out of there. I understood from that angle. But no, I went into it genuinely believing that it was going to be okay. And I just had this blind faith in the humanity of the world. Unfortunately, I was right in many situations, and we only had a handful, which were, like you say, were pretty scary. But I suppose the other thing to say is that when we planned the route, I remember, you know, speaking with my parents and saying, well, why are you doing like Syria and Yemen and all of the scary ones last? And it was like, well, look, if I'm going to die somewhere, I'd rather see most of the world first.
Yeah.
And so we kind of did it that way around. But in hindsight, that was probably a little bit silly because it got very stressful in those countries. But we made it to the end. And like you say, we did have some scary moments.
For sure. And look, even places like Sierra Leone, and I know you've said previously, like it's such a genuinely beautiful country, you know, and there's a lot that are quite similar. How can you see what's going on here, the horrific conditions people are living in, the high mortality rates? Like they have nothing yet. Like you say, they're so happy. And it's a whole lot of confusion. How do you make sense of that?
Yeah, that is a very good question as well. I think the thing with Sierra Leone is people are so poor. There's this huge direct correlation, strong correlation between people without and their want to give. Is very strange, and it's almost paradoxical, where you go to these countries like Sierra Leone and everybody on the street corners, they're not coming up to you and begging for food or money. They are willingly giving their time and water and anything they have to support you. And I just don't understand that. it is bizarre. And so seeing all of that, it it changed everything in me, because there are so many people suffering that could. There's a brilliant book called Factfulness, actually. And it's about some scientists, social scientists, who and basically done some research about the real facts of the world and how it all works. And it touches upon the different stages of poverty and how much just $1 to a person per day. So let's say $365 per year, that money can literally change their life forever. And for us, it's like, I don't know, the cost of half a phone or a quarter of a phone. And we just didn't think about it. But seeing these people in these places, it really stuck home how powerful just having that little bit extra support. Sierra Leone was powerful because, as I say in the book, I went to the children's hospital and witnessed some just horrendous things. And then I put a plea out on social media trying to help this one particular person to get some medication and some clothing and some food for her kids. And I was inundated with support, and we ended up being able to give plenty of cash to these people. But then I realized that just giving money to random people is never going to work long term. So that's when we set up my foundation, the 196 Foundation, which we're just about to relaunch actually in a couple of weeks, which is designed about to take £1.96 per person from per month, as like you and I, just random donors anywhere in the world. And then we put that in a pot, and then we deliver a project that can support people in other countries, just like the Sierra Leone hospital, when we're, you know, in making sure that they have doctors or x-ray machines. Or I was just so shocked. The hospital I went to see in Sierra Leone was effectively just a building with some volunteer nurses and doctors and some grubby beds. You know, it wasn't a hospital that we would assume as a hospital with equipment and medicine and skills. It was just anybody that they could get to help in an empty building. And that was the main hospital in the entire country. So it So I could talk all day about that kind of side of it. I still can't get my head around it, in all honesty. And that's why I guess the foundation's hoping to touch on more of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, looking at this correlation between having little objects and having more happiness, has that kind of brought to light this whole concept of minimalism to you, if you've heard of that?
Yeah, that's true. That's really true. I think there's a really happy medium. I do see some people trying to be, what's the word? Kind of fashionably minimal.
Yeah, like really reductionist.
Yeah, and I think actually that's okay, but we do also have other, you know, I'm not going to just stop using my phone or stop using my laptop because I want to be minimal. There's a few pieces of equipment, but I do now, as I've said in the book, you know, I sold a lot of stuff to make the trip happen, and I've come back, and now I live in a van full time. I don't need to live in a house. And when you do that, let alone traveling around the world, you understand how little you need. You basically just need yourself and friends. Honestly, that's it, the power of people being able to help you. And so that old adage of, you know, it's who you know, not what you know, that's so true, because you can pretty much get by with just some great friendships. And maybe if you've got a few pounds here and there, and I'm talking like minimal, and you know, we spend tiny amounts of money in our van, and we're still living relatively luxuriously in terms of the scheme of the world. We have a fridge, and we have a cooker, and we have heating, and like there's literally millions of people, tens of millions of people around the world that don't have any of that. So people that say to me, "Oh, well, how's minimal life living in a van?" I'm like, "It's okay. It's more minimal than living in a house, but it's actually really luxurious compared to most of the countries I've seen." So I think I'm living in the happy medium of appreciating minimalism, but also realizing I'm not really minimal because I've got everything around me that I want.
I love it. Look, and you do have an incredibly beautiful van build. What inspired you to take on the van life?
It was the same kind of concept. I wanted to be able to travel with my work, being running, and it made no sense to be in one place because I was just never there. And then the world taught me that. The world taught me that it was so easy to step away from loads of gadgets and gear and having a like wardrobes and wardrobes full of clothes, when actually you just need like a few t-shirts here and there. And if you buy a new one, then it's because the old one is completely ruined or tatty, or you don't need it anymore, or maybe somebody else wants it. You know, I've done that a few times with friends. I'm like, oh, I like your shoes. And they're like, oh, I like your shoes. I'm like, well, should we swap? And like,
I love that.
Like, do you want, what about, let's just swap t-shirts for a few days? Like, just super simple stuff, because it's like, it's just not needed. So no, the van, I would recommend anybody to live in a van for a period of time, like at least a year. Like, do a year in a van, like a converted van or a camper van, and just move around, because the world does open up more when you do that. And you're also almost living outside the whole time. Even though you're in a van, you've got windows and doors that's open the whole time, and you just kind of feel a little bit in touch with the world more.
I love it. And look, you mentioned before your work is being a runner, and I know you have a marathon plan, I think, if I remember correctly, coming out. But in preface to that, what tips would you have for someone who's looking to get into running?
Yeah, cool. So there's a few people that I coach and train, and I have the people that come to me that believe that they... So the number one tip is that you have to want to run yourself. You can't just want to run because somebody else has gone, oh, I'm running, you should too. You have to really want to do it. Otherwise, it's going to be a real uphill struggle. So I think that's the other thing. Number two is try and realize that if you want to get to the point that you're enjoying running, you have to go past the unenjoyable bit, which is the training and the learning, your teaching your body to learn all of the how to suffer sometimes, even that over that 10 minutes or 10 hours of running, whatever it may be. But the almighty gift you get when you get to that point, and it doesn't take too long, it can take only a few months to properly get into running, is this overpowering feeling of peace and calm and serenity when you run. You know, take the music out, try and take your watch off, just get your trainers on, get your shoes on, and go for a jog, and let yourself be in your own head. I think that's the most amazing thing, and that's why I love it, because it's like therapy, but without the cost. Unless you run around the world, then it just gets a bit expensive. But no, my last tip, actually, my most practical tip, I suppose, is if nobody's ever run before, get yourself a new pair of shoes and run every day for 30 days. Now, I'm not telling you to just, that sounds crazy to a lot of people, but I'm basically saying just get out of the house with your trainers on every single day for 30 days, even if it's just walking half a mile, and creating that habit. Really starts you to get into the routine of appreciating the outdoors more. And then the more you're outdoors, the more you want to be outdoors. And just that basic habit, then you're not thinking about the effort of getting ready. I had spoken to some people and they say, oh yeah, my pre-run routine starts 3 hours before because I have to get up and I have to have breakfast and have to rest. I'm like, no, just any time of day, just put your shoes on and go outside. That's the beauty of running. It's simple. So 30 days of running, on the bounce, after having done nothing, just get your trainers on and go outside. And no matter what, stick to the 30 days. And I guarantee you, by the time you get to the end, you will want to do more.
I love it. And look, I want to get you to give us advice on the complete other side. And I want to know, what does it take to be an ultra runner?
Stubbornness, I suppose. Stubbornness, a little bit of selfishness, actually, because you do have to sacrifice quite a lot to do that, because it's, you know, you're away from your family and your friends. And I mean, running the world was a classic example. You know, great friends of mine that I've had all my life growing up with at school, you instantly disappear and you're in foreign countries all the time and you lose touch. And so being able to make sure that you're balancing that, you kind of have to be a little bit aware that you're being selfish in one way or another. Stubbornness is genuinely a good answer, I think, for how to be an ultra runner. You also then have to learn to endure the pain and the aches and pains. And the biggest thing of all, I think, is to understand that the mind controls the body, not the other way around. Because a lot of people say to me, oh, I can't go for a run today. I've hurt my knee. So no, you're letting your brain tell yourself that your knee is really hurting. And of course, broken bones and things like that, you can't escape. But you can learn to push through more pain than you appreciate than usual. And I mean, I think many people on lots of podcasts for decades before me have said the same thing. It's just understanding what your brain does and learning and educating yourself about, you know, how much sleep you need or the right foods you need. And as my dad would always say to me as a kid, if you want to do something, then try it once. And if you want to get better at it, then practice it. That's it. Like that's the only reason you go from a runner to an ultra runner, just do it more and run further. So I think the other thing actually with ultra running is that it isn't actually the same sport, in my opinion, as running, because it's a completely different kettle of fish. You're not running to like super speeds. You're just trotting along in your own mind, kind of chilling out. And then you also run for longer through darkness, through. So it's just a magical world. I love it.
So last year, I think it was, you originally came on my radar when you had a chat with Mr. Roll. And of course he did his thing, and from my stalking on the interwebs, introduced you to a plant-based lifestyle. How have you found it? Are you still sticking to it?
So I'm more flexible, but I've learned from since Rich, since Rich Roll, I've learned of the wonders of a different diet that is completely sustainable and actually incredibly healthy. And the more and more people that come to me, I'm amazed actually how many people come to me and they go, oh no, I'm a vegan. And like 20 years ago, I don't think I knew anybody that was a vegan. So it's massive. And obviously there's a reason for it. So I'm definitely flexible. I will have, I will eat meat and I will eat dairy sometimes, but meat especially is something that is much less now. And it's not something I immediately go for. If I can see an equivalent in a shop, then I would go for that. And I also feel cleaner on the inside. It kind of feels a bit strange, actually. It just feels like I've been shoveling rubbish in my body, and then all of a sudden I've learned that. And it's also not health foods. That's another thing I've kind of learned. It's not just health foods that you need to eat. It's just natural goodness. So I'm still learning a lot about it, to be honest. And I don't think I'll ever get to the point. I don't know if anybody does. Maybe Rich does. Maybe you do. I just constantly thinking of ways. And I'm just about to go off and do another trip. And so I'm wondering whether I can do something that is completely plant-based, and whether or not I'm going to, because I'm a bit scared, in all honesty, to change completely for a big mission, because it's an unknown. But I do want to do that one day, to have complete vegan journey, whatever it may be. I wasn't expecting to get that from Rich. I obviously knew all about him and his veganism, but I wasn't expecting to be. I just was struck by how well he looked. It's like, this is like, you're twice my age, I think, and you look incredibly healthy and well. He gave me his books, and I flicked through them and started to do a bit of my own cooking and stuff. So it's changed. I think it's changed me a lot.
I mean, I think you're right in saying, like, nowadays it is a very, very different thing. I mean, especially because you see a lot of people obviously coming up to you, be like, I'm vegan, and that was literally probably unheard of 20 years ago. And now you have like the likes of Rich Roll and like Scott Jurek, especially if you're looking at like athletes that just doing stupid things, but just, and a lot of the time, I think, and I talk about this a lot and I might get vilified a little bit, but it's about just increasing your plant intake. I don't think, I think obviously you can live a fully fulfilling, thriving lifestyle, fully plant-based. Obviously, like, we have 100,000 people that have achieved that, but also increasing your plant intake. It's insane what will happen if you just get to like 80%, 90%. Yeah. So I think what you're doing is a great start. And maybe it's something that you take a bit of your running advice and you just do a little more plant every day.
Well, that's so true. And I've got a good couple of friends who I actually called up after speaking with Rich, and one of my mates called John, who actually ran with me on Running the World. And I said, John, I know you're vegan. How did you make the switch? And he said the same thing. He was like, just have like a dedicated day where you're vegan purely, and then make it like 2 days, and then make it 3 days as you progress. And I was like, no, I'm an all or nothing person. I'm going to go all out or not at all. But I can say that he was absolutely right, because it is so difficult to make that immediate switch, because all of a sudden you don't have any of the knowledge about what foods you should be eating. Totally. what am I going to like have my cereal with? Like, what? and you go through the, and you're like, hang on a minute, this is really hard. And so he was right, just to use one day and actually think about it and plan it and do it actively as opposed to just passively. So that taught me a lot. So no, I think you're right. I think in order, if I was going to go and plan a journey, plan an expedition, a running trip, and being completely vegan, I'm going to have to learn more. Maybe we can speak again and I can work that out, because I know there's a bunch of foods I've still not discovered. I mean, totally. I think it is also, I guess, the rise of the popularity in the mainstream culture with veganism is that there's also a lot of other food that's popping up that is vegan, but it's not very good vegan.
Oh, absolutely. Vegan, like, by no means means healthy. No, that is a moral ethos to follow. We're talking like more whole foods, plant-based, especially if you want the longevity and the thriving athlete diet kind of thing. But I would find it quite interesting to see your experience in finding some foods that are like, oh crap, that's not plant-based, but other foods like, oh, that was always plant-based and I've always been consuming that. Especially like, I think Marmite similar to Vegemite, like that's plant-based. Yeah. Like a lot of things that you probably consume are already there. It's just a matter of learning the label game, really.
Yeah, and learning to substitute correctly. So like, you know, if I'm substituting, I don't know, let's say milk for another milk, you have a whole, literally an entire aisle of alternative milks. And you're like, well, which one should I have? And so then that's just a matter of A, taste, and B, kind of understanding the sustainability behind each of them. And, you know, is it soy? Is it coconut? Is it almond? Do I have, like, am I okay to have like a bit of caramel with the almond? You know, all of this stuff. And then it gets really, but I love that. I do love that. I mean, at the moment, I think over the last, you know, when we did Italy and in France, my diet's been awful in comparison. But nowhere near as bad as it used to be, if that makes sense. So I think it's definitely makes you healthier being plant-based, even if you're not strict.
Absolutely. Look, and on the basis of being ethical and sustainable, your whole trip was carbon offset. Why and how did you do that?
Oh, yeah, this is a good subject because we're doing loads more with it now. And since coming back from that journey, having learned about it, we have also set up our initiative called Free Your Footprint, which is a nonprofit that we started, which is basically our plan is to make every runner on the planet an environmental activist, but without them having to do anything other than continue to run. And so we're trying to offset every runner's carbon emissions in the entire world through lots of partnerships that we're building. And so I think we're going to try and revolutionize the way runners interact with the environmental landscape. And this was what I learned through running the world. So why did we do it? The honest answer is I knew nothing about environmentalism or what offsetting was, other than the obvious answer, which was you plant a tree, you save the world, which I think is the general standard. And then the other side of it was that I didn't want to get horrendous media for traveling around the world trying to raise money for cancer if I'm then killing the planet. And so I was like, we need to do something. And then I discovered that there's a lot of stuff out there that you can do, and it's much more complex and much more positively impacting than just planting trees or just offsetting your carbon. And so we worked with a company called Natural Capital Partners, and what they did was they deliver projects all over the world, and they created four projects for us that meant that we had 45 tons of CO2 equivalent that we needed to offset. Now, that effectively meant that rather than just planting a million trees, which is more difficult and actually not the cheapest way of being carbon neutral, because there's, you know, you've got hydro, you've got wind, you've got solar. There's so many different ways of looking at it. But I'll give you one example. So a company that we're still doing stuff with now, and we're about to talk about them a lot more on my next trip because we're working with them again, is a company called Ecofiltro. And they're based in Guatemala. And they deliver water filtration pots to families. And off the back of our journey with Ecofiltro as well, there was 400,000 families affected by giving clean water by Ecofiltro. And what that means in terms of offsetting, you think, well, how does that help the planet? Well, people that don't have clean water have to boil their water in order to make it drinkable. And if you have to boil the water, then you have to cut down trees, and that's not very helpful for the planet. But you also have to burn that wood, which is also not very helpful for the planet or the person, because you're breathing in fumes in a small space. And so I learned that this carbon offsetting is so much more than just helping the planet. It's helping the people help the planet. And so being able to give this one pot per family is 5 years of clean water, which means every single day of those 5 years, they don't need to cut down wood, burn wood to heat their water, so they can get rid of the bad bits in the water. And so I learned so much that it's more about working with the communities in order to be able to do that. And so we had a project in Mongolia where we insulated yurts, and so the same sort of thing. They don't have to burn so much wood to keep warm. And also in Kenya, there was two other projects in Kenya. So basically, it opened my eyes to how much we can do, which doesn't necessarily involve the very obvious one of planting trees. You can do more to help the planet. So does that answer your question? I know I've gone off on a tangent.
Absolutely, it does. I think, you know, the main thing was why was it important to you? And, you know, bad media is one, but I think in hindsight, looking at your question with a bit more of a microscope, I think what it meant to you is becoming educated of what that could actually do for other people, because carbon offset is really just a word that we've given. Traveling is a luxury, and it's just bringing that luxury to the communities.
Yeah. And travel is increasingly becoming more environmentally friendly. And I think in our lifetimes and our children's lifetimes, the whole world is going to have to be revolutionized in terms of how we use fuel and how we travel, because it's just dying. You know, there's a fantastic book, and I recommend this to anybody, by David Attenborough, his latest book. And he speaks, I listen to all my books. I don't read them because I'm running all the time. So I listen to the books, and it's so powerful with how much of the planet we have used. And it just makes you immediately want to do something. And I'm hoping that what we're doing with Free Your Footprint is being able to give a little outlet so people can offset their carbon emissions. And actually, we are going to be giving away your annual offset per person. So I could say to you, right, we're going to make you carbon neutral for 2021. We're going to be giving away 100 days of 100 people's worth every day of my next trip. So, and that's with just partnerships that we're working with. So it's super exciting to be able to do stuff with the planet. And I hope, and I'm kind of feeling like when I do have children and they get older, I can't imagine that they're not going to be involved in the environmental bit, because I think it's going to be their generation. You know, it's going to be their time to save the planet, where we've kind of, you know, tried to stop war and maybe do those kind of things. What the next generation is going to try and do is just try and make sure the planet keeps spinning safely.
But at the same time, you know, making sure that we don't leave everything to the next generation. I think also, you know, doing our part as well and doing as much as we can just so they don't hate us, you know.
That's so true. Yeah, well, that's the thing. And I think the groundwork's there. You know, we're going to be part of COP26, which is in Glasgow in November. And we're going to be going along to that and having a bit of a representing the runner's voice. And so, of course, there's so much we can do now. I just want to prep it, almost like laying the foundations for some really great work that come, because we're not going to be able to solve it in our time. So, but I think it can be solved in the next generation.
Yeah. Look, you've made a lot of connections, both pre-trip, during your trip and post-trip. And a lot of the time that can just come from saying hi to random people. And the thought of this can trigger a lot of uncomfortability in people. And I know you were shy as a kid. So I want to know, how did you break that barrier to now have the confidence to just say hi?
That's so good. Yeah, I honestly don't know. I was so shy. I was cripplingly shy as a child. And I think I was a bit scared of the world. And I guess the difference now is that I am like impatient with the world, because I want to see all of it and I want to experience everybody's, you know, stories that they have to tell. And I think there was a bit of a switch in my mind when I discovered sport, because I had an outlet to kind of file away and tidy my thoughts, if you like. And so I wasn't as fearful. It's so difficult. I mean, let's just say you're on a plane, for example, and you've sat down, you're traveling on your own, and you don't know the person next to you. Before, there wouldn't be anything in my head that would say, right, well, let's have a conversation with this person, because there would be thoughts like, well, why would they want to speak to me? Or is that, that's just weird. But actually, we're all human beings, and the chances are that the person right next to you is going to have something in common, or even if they have nothing in common, you can learn something from one another. You know, I've sat next to people on planes and running the world that have never been on a plane before or left their country. And that is the most remarkable thing to experience, and to be able to help somebody put their seatbelt on because they've never, you know, how many of us get on a plane and we're like, oh, here we go again, the safety announcement, and we have to listen to the safety announcement. And then there's still loads of people that haven't experienced that. And experiencing that firsthand, watching somebody that doesn't know how to put a plane seatbelt on or has ever left their country, it teaches you something. And another classic example, when I was running in Oman, running along the beach in the, it was late, about midnight, I think. There was a lone guy running along the beach. And I just thought, right, well, there's only me and him here. And he's a bit weird if we don't run, don't talk to each other, because like we're both human beings and in the middle of this random beach. And I said, oh, hi. And he said, oh, yeah, I'm training for a race. And he spoke English and we got chatting. And then that one thing led to another. And he said, well, no, I can give you a lift back to the hotel when we finish running. We finished the run together. And then I went back to his house to offer me a lift. And he said, actually, well, if you want to come in, it was like 1 o'clock in the morning. And I thought, well, this is strange. And then he then woke his wife and his son up and said, we've just met this guy. He's running around the world. Let's make him some dinner. He's hungry. And I'll then drive him back to his hotel. And not only that, but they also gave me like fresh clothes to have a shower and go. It's just like,
what?
This all came from, that's in the book as well. You'll get to that. This all came from just one random conversation of me just sidling up to somebody. And so the opportunities that leads to are just, and I've still in contact with them now. So just more and more conversations, even if it doesn't go anywhere initially or ever, it's still worth kind of shining a little bit of light on each other. One more little story on that point, because there's, again, I was running a race in Silverstone race circuit in the UK years ago, about five, maybe longer, 6 years ago. And it was raining after the race. I was sheltering under the hangar. And there was this guy there called Veton, and I just got chatting to him. I just kind of said, oh, hi, all the rain's bad, isn't it? Some small British small talk. And then he's like, oh, yeah, actually, I come from Kosovo originally. And I said, oh, cool. And he said, well, if you ever come to Kosovo, then let me know. And that was years before I was thinking about running the world. And then 4 years later, having never spoken to the guy since, but having his details, I arrived in Kosovo and he was at the airport to pick me up and host me in Kosovo. And this was just from one like 10 second conversation. And then that led to the fact that I then learned that he was used to work for the United Nations. And then he then opened up loads of other doors, which meant that I could access these countries more safely and have the UN to help me. And without him, he then wouldn't have put me in touch with his friend who ran the compound in Afghanistan in Kabul. So I wouldn't have been able to run there safely without his support. And so much so that I then hired him 6 months later as my assistant, and he managed the rest of my journey for me throughout running the world. And that came from just one random conversation like half a decade earlier in the rain somewhere. And we didn't know each other from Adam, but we just had something in common and it worked. So I think the answer is you just got to swallow that fear, because there's so many more opportunities that you get by speaking to people.
I am really flabbergasted by that story. I'm a bit sad that you spoiled a few cities for me and countries, but that's okay. Look, better hear it from the man himself. So look, what's next for you?
Oh, we've got loads of stuff. We've basically got the next few years planned out in terms of trips, because I think one thing about running the world that taught me is that I do have to spend a little bit longer planning stuff in order to get it right. And so we've got a big trip in 2023, which is going to be a couple of world records and a new world first, which I can't say too much about, but I will say it is. Yeah, it is. Bigger than I have ever done and probably will ever do. It's going to be the biggest thing I will take on. But something that's happening relatively soon, I am going to try and break the world record for running around Britain. And I had lots of other plans in different countries. And I thought, you know what, I've done the world and I haven't actually gone around my own country. And so let's do this. And it's good timing with the with COVID. We're coming out of lockdown officially as of the 21st of June. And so the whole country will be open up. There's no rules. And so by the time I finish, we'll have a load of people to run with me. So that's going to be the current record, I think, is about 300 and something days around the country. But I'm going to try and do it in 100.
Whoa.
Which means,
yeah, what?
Yeah, which means I'm going to hopefully be running 2 marathons a day for 100 days, which has never been done either. So that's a nice little tick in the box for me, like endurance wise. So that's happening from the 12th of April. Like, that's soon.
Oh, that's exciting. So this episode will come out, I think, on the 29th of April. So you would have already done that. So I'll have to include that in the intro.
There you go. Yeah, I'll literally be running as it goes out. Yeah.
That's awesome. Look, we all know your journey was inspiring, thrilling, and, well, really a great learning opportunity both for yourself and through the book and podcast, everyone else gets to learn from your amazing trip. Look, you can read all about it in your new book, Running the World. That's available on Amazon, UK Bookshop, Waterstone, and in your local bookshop as well. Looking closing, do you have any final words of wisdom that you'd love to leave us with that could be related to something we were talking about, or could be something completely random, mate? The platform is all yours.
Thank you, mate. Now, I'd like to say that I just want to give everybody in the world that has the privilege and luxuries of that we do just a bit of a shake. I think anybody that's listening to this has the opportunity to do anything they want to. And we didn't have the money or the knowledge or the means or literally any idea really what we were doing when we set off with Running the World. And it's completely compounded the belief that you can do anything you set your mind to. But more importantly, we don't just have the luxury and the privilege to do so. We have the responsibility to absolutely eke every bit of life out of the world that we do, because there's so many people out there that don't have the freedoms. You know, some people don't even have the freedom to choose their own religion or to choose where they work or to choose who they believe in or to choose how they earn money. And we have so much freedom. Life is too short just to put off your dreams to tomorrow, because the reality, like Kevin experiences, that sometimes your life can be cut short. And I think the final thing to say on that point is, don't be afraid to think about death that way. You know, we it's kind of a little bit of a taboo thing that we don't, as human beings, like, kind of, as soon as you talk about death, it gets morbid and miserable. And actually, it shouldn't be that. It should be a celebration of what time we have now. And so I'm certainly going to just spend the rest of my life having adventure, trying to do some good in the process, and leaving a trail of enjoyment behind me with everybody that I'm hoping to be, you know, to be in touch with. So just use your life, because it's very, very precious.
Awesome. I love all that. And look, to finish us up, I want to thank you on behalf of myself as a human being and on behalf of Plant Paradigm Community, just for firstly sharing your amazing experience with the world, but also given how extensive your travel is, I really appreciate the fact that it was carbon offset, and the fact that you are doing all these amazing things that I would put as quite altruistic. And you really don't have to do any of that, but I know you do have a soul that loves to connect and help with people. So it definitely doesn't go unnoticed, and we really appreciate it as fellow human beings of this planet. Thanks, Nick.
No, thank you, Tom. And I, the last thing I will say is that thank you to you and for everybody that listens, because you give me the platform and people like me the platform to be able to share it. There's no point running around the world if we can't then share the messages of what it means. So similar message back to you, mate. I'm really grateful for it. Great, really great to chat.
Hi, welcome to the end of the episode. What an insane journey. Like, his stories, like, surely there's no better person qualified to tell campfire stories. He's just such a talented storyteller, but also he has a cacophony of stories he can call upon. The one thing I took away that I really love is his compassion towards other people. Like, it's so easy to look around and see the negatives in the world, but it's true that there are so many ways to look at the world in a positive light. So thank you, Nick, once again for coming on and sharing this amazing conversation. I'm excited to see your journey around the UK and your journey and all the amazing world records you'll be attempting, you crazy, crazy person. I love it. So if you enjoyed this conversation, as always, I've left all of the ways to connect with Nick in the show notes below. And of course, you can connect with us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Facebook, all good stuff. And if you did enjoy our conversation, the best way to help out is to leave us a 5-star review on Apple or iTunes. And of course, if you have a friend who loves fitness, loves travel, maybe loves spreading kindness, this would be a nice episode to send to them, because I think we touched on so many things that people would love to listen to. But that is all from me today. I will see you guys on next week's episode. Stay happy, eat plants, peace.